Hi, this is Jim.
And this is Max.
Check out our podcast, The Step Over, Liberty Ballers Podcast Network, for all of your Sixers needs.
Player analysis, game breakdowns, who would look coolest in a headband, and more.
Subscribe to Liberty Ballers Podcast feed on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts, and check out The Step Over, a podcast about Sixers basketball.
Mostly.
It's out of here! Home run, Lenny Dykstra!
Stairs rips one into the night, deep into right, way out of here.
The Phillies win the game on a base hit by Mitch Williams at 4:40 in the morning.
Swing and a miss, struck him out. It's wacky, wonderful. Bunch of throwbacks has won the National League pennant.
Welcome to Continued Success, a new era of the podcast for which you used to pay $5, and we are ever so grateful. But I am Justin Clue, the assistant editor of The Good Fight, and with me as always is the managing editor of The Good Fight, Liz Rocher. We host this Phillies podcast to talk about not only just whatever's on our mind as far as baseball and the Phillies, but also to track the historic seasons of the 1993 and 2008 Phillies, both of which are celebrating anniversaries this year. Liz, this is a somewhat better morning than the past mornings we've talked about as far as the Phillies game that happened last night. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling very good, thank you. I'm feeling good. Last night's game was, it kept me right on the edge of my seat, cheering and yelling like a crazy person in my own home. It was a fun game.
We're not speaking in ambiguities because we want to be able to put this podcast up at any point. Last night was the Red Sox, the second time the Phillies played the Red Sox for two games. And so that was obviously appointment television. I wish we could have kept going and just been like, yes, last night's game had many innings. The pitches were my favorite part, thrown by the various players of the Philadelphia Phillies.
I also enjoyed the running.
Oh, yes.
All the running that was done.
When the Phillies wear their red caps, boy, you know they mean business. But yes, no, last night was one of the, the last time the Phillies will play the Red Sox in the regular season, two-game set after splitting a two-game set with them a couple weeks ago. And this series in Philadelphia was no less dramatic, I would say. Dramatic is an accurate word, but also frustrating. I feel like that, especially that first game, you could tell the mood, just the general mood, the general vibe, the aura surrounding Philadelphia really shifted from game to game. And it was only a two-game series. So you can tell, the attendance and fan enthusiasm right now has been brought into question. That's something I don't really care about. But as far as just people paying attention, you could really tell that these two games especially were enough to at least affect people's days the next day. You try to act like you don't respond to a baseball game in the regular season with as much emotion as you would an NFL game because they play so many games. But these two games seem to really have an impact on people. Certainly I was not immune to that. And that first game was very frustrating. Like the first game they played of the last two game set where Aaron Nola pitched so well and the Phillies couldn't hit. This time, Zach Eflin, I believe, made the start, and they were able to, it wasn't a high scoring game. They were able to keep the Red Sox pretty much at bay, but the Phillies just weren't hitting and they weren't scoring. And then last night you put Wilson Ramos in the lineup and what do you know? There's a huge change. And I mean, hey, look, I certainly was making sarcastic comments about how, like, look, this team has looked so dead. I don't think that a Wilson Ramos coming back from a hamstring injury is really going to be able to affect things too much. You know, you don't picture your 31-year-old catcher thundering to third base necessarily after legging out a triple. But that's exactly what happened. And he had a hell of a game. And the Phillies pulled it off, a 7-4 win against the Red Sox, the best team in baseball. So I don't know. I mean, are you learning a lesson at all, Liz, about generally responding so quickly to one game sample sizes?
No.
Yeah, I mean,
we run a podcast. which we have a special announcement about coming right up. But we run a podcast. Like, we do this a couple times a week. If we don't have reactions to every game, why are we doing this? You know, we're not trying to convince people like that, you know, what happened tonight is the best / the worst thing to happen in the entire year. You know, we're not really going to know that until the end of the season. I mean, this people said, you know, last night was the most important win of the season. And it might be when it's all said and done. But I think that's also been said at least four other times. Yes. At least, if not longer. Like Michael Franco's walk-off.
Yep.
That was the most important win of the season. You know, the other win against the Red Sox was the most important win of the season. I've been so impressed with what the Phillies have shown against the Red Sox. They haven't been, you know, the games have been frustrating, but in that, you know, it wasn't angry making. It was, God, you guys can do so much better, and we all know it.
I remember, you know, thinking
missed chances and stuff like that. But I mean, they kept it close, except in the last game when they beat the crap out of them, sort of.
I remember thinking when Wilson Ramos had like his third extra base hit of the night, that this is either going to be the biggest win or the worst loss of the Philly season. Like now, like this is the narrative was lining up so perfectly to be like, okay, look, the Phillies have all their guns now. They have Wilson Ramos in the lineup. He's being even more effective than anyone would have guessed right off the bat. So if they go ahead, like, you know, 7-3 and then wind up losing, then it's going to be the most crushing defeat of the season. Or if they win, it's going to be like the most reinvigorating win. But I mean, that's more a sign, I think, of what kind of team this is, that every night seems to redefine them as what kind of season they're having and what kind of team they are. But I don't know. Even after that win, it's still very fresh in my mind, the image of this offense being just really just a limp rag out there and just accomplishing nothing and looking like they are just swinging their fists at the ball and not even taking bats into the batter's box. So we'll see what happens. What are we about to start? Is it a 4-game series with the Mets?
No, it's a 5-gamer. It's a 5-gamer. It's a doubleheader friggin' today.
Oh, yeah. Ah, well, I guess the biggest thing you got to worry about when you're playing the Mets for such a prolonged time is just the exposure. And you got to worry about contracting whatever, bacterial infections they have at the moment. So as long as the players keep their distance and don't have any open wounds exposed to directly to the Mets, I think the Phillies should come out of this one okay. But yeah, Liz, you mentioned some big news. And now that we've got all our instant Phillies reactions off our chests, maybe you want to fill the people in on what exactly the big news is for continued success, as well as, you know, Phillies podcasting in general.
Well, the big news is that we are we're going to be winding down our Patreon because we are now a SB Nation podcast. Us and our wonderful colleagues at Liberty Ballers, at Bleeding Green Nation, at Broad Street Hockey. They are, we are all taking our podcast to SB Nation. And we're all at least putting our Patreon on pause. We're not going to end it. We're not ending it forever. This is all just sort of an experiment, an incubator, if you will. But all episodes from now on, continued success, hit and season, and the dirty inning. We're bringing the dirty inning into the embrace of the Good Fight podcasts. Enveloping you in our baseball arms, and all of those will be for free and on one feed, the Good Fight podcast feed. We will be able to give you information on how to sign up for that. Tell your friends, tell your family. Now it's all free. No one has to pay to listen to us. And for those of you who are on Patreon, we thank you so much for your support during this season. You are why we're able to do this, why we were able to be noticed and taken seriously. We are so grateful to you. We're going to have a few more Patreon-only episodes to wrap things up, sort of, and then we're going to put it on pause. If we come back, hopefully you'll all stay with us on Patreon, but we of course understand if when the time comes, if it comes, if you want to move on. But we think this is a good opportunity for us and to be in it with the rest of the Philly Sports SB Nation podcast is really exciting to sort of launch with a big trumpeting, you know, force of Philly sports. No other city's getting this. It's just us here. So that's how special we all are.
And let me just say that if anyone just wants to give us money because they like us, that's perfectly also acceptable. This doesn't have to be the end of you giving us money just because you want to. I think we fully support that. It's just not something you have to do anymore. You're not required to contribute $5 to hear anything. It's going to be, just super available. But again, you know, if you just want to, if you just like hear the sounds of our voice and think, you know what, this makes me want to open my wallet. You know, don't, you know, follow that instinct. That's a good one. But yeah, exciting times for this podcast. Exciting times for the Phillies. Exciting times in Philadelphia sports, Liz. What a time. What an era to be alive. So obviously we took an interest in what the Phillies were up to when they were playing the Red Sox. But just looking around the NL East right now, there's, it seems like there's plenty of not just interesting stories, but drama. Because this is like the messy bitch that loves drama division this year. And nowhere was there more drama than in the Braves-Marlins game last night when Jose Urena hit Ronald Acuna Jr. with a pitch for, oh man, obvious reasons? It was obvious, right? Like, there was nothing not obvious about that. There was the only time that was more obvious was when Cole Hamels hit Bryce Harper with a pitch and then was like, yeah, I hit him on purpose. So that happened. Jose Urena pretty much did that without saying it. I mean, how many home runs did Ronald Acuna have going into that game? He'd let off, what, like five straight games with home runs?
Yeah, something like that. God, I hate him. I really do. He's so frustrating. Like, I would love to just love him, and if he was on a non-NL East team, I could. But, like, I have no ability to enjoy him and Juan Soto. I don't think that means they should be hit with pitches, but...
I mean, I don't hate them yet. I mean, I'll hate them the second they're playing the Phillies. I love it. I think it's great. I love when a player is so frustrating to another team that they feel like they have to resort to, you know, violence, that they have to resort to hurting him physically in order to stop him. Obviously, the better option would have been, you know, you could have like worked really hard to like get him out, you know, because it's baseball. But no, I mean, we can't do it. We bypass all that. And if they didn't want to pitch to him, they could have just walked him. So it was as absurd as that situations get, but even absurd for one of those situations. And it just sucks. It's like, it's not supposed to be that way. And I get it. I get, you know, Keith Hernandez, the Mets broadcaster. He went on I guess you could call it a rant, talking about how like, yeah, that's what you have to do. You have to like put one in his ribs, like don't throw it in anybody's head, but like you got to hurt a player like that, a young player, to like, you know, put, I guess, bring him back down to earth, to like make it seem like maybe he's getting a little too full of himself. And then Braves announcers were like, oh, why did he hit him? He wasn't like flipping his bat or pimping his home run or anything, as if that would be a reasonable time to hit somebody with a pitch. Like it's all the same shit. Like it's the same shit we talk about all the time, multiple times every year, because it keeps happening. And us talking about it isn't going to stop it from happening. It's just so like childish almost, you know, I don't like this, so I'm going to hurt you. I get the old school idea behind it, and I understand how putting a guy in his place like that makes sense to somebody who comes from that school of thought. But at the same time, that just seems dumb. Like it just seems immature and like the wrong way to go about things. But hey, you know, if a guy's in your head that much, that's how you respond, I don't know what to tell you. Get him out. I know you're unable to, and that's why you're in that position, but good Lord.
Well, Justin, once upon a time, I remember when Cole Hamels plunked Bryce Harper, a young debuting rookie Bryce Harper. I think it must have been in April of that year when they, you know, first played each other. And he plunked him, I believe, like on the thigh or the hip, you know, somewhere meaty where, you know, theoretically less damage can be done. But he, like, I'll give Cole Hamels some credit. He straight up admitted it. I'm pretty sure he said, yeah, I hit him on purpose. That was, and that's why he was
that was the dumbest
suspended.
Part of it, though. That was like,
really?
You never admit that you hit a guy. That's how you get suspended. And then the Phillies lost Cole Hamels for at least a game. Like, that was the goofiest part of it. I was like, what are you doing, man?
I loved that. I'm just, he's like, yeah, this is how it's been done forever. It's like he was exposing something really dumb. Like, I kind of liked that, because whether he meant to or not, he put it all out on Front Street and said, yeah, this is how it's been done forever. And so I felt that I was expected to do it, and that is why I did it. And now that's why I'm suspended. Thank you all very much.
That just went into the idea of Cole Hamels, like trying to be a hard baseball. Cole Hamels is not a player from like the old school, mentality that from which this philosophy comes. He's, you know, they called him Hollywood. Yeah. He's got long hair. He just came from the beach. He probably smells like sunscreen, and he's just not like somebody you can imagine like adhering to that. He's the kind of guy that they're like, okay, now you got to go on him and hit him on purpose. And like, I guess he'll do it because he's a team player, but he's also just like, okay guys, that's what we're gonna do. Him admitting it was on purpose just cracks me up, because I imagine him thinking of himself as like John Doe in the movie Seven, where he's just like comes into the police station, he's like, detective.
it's not that he isn't a player with mental toughness, but if you he has a personal Twitter account, which he tweeted on yesterday for the first time in maybe 3 months. Something about restaurant recommendations, maybe? I'm not sure.
Awesome.
But you look at his Twitter account, and he's got his arms open, and he's just like smiling a little farther away. You know, the picture's taken from farther away. It's like, hey guys, you want some wine? I got some nachos here. There's some pretzels in a bowl. Come on in.
I gotta say,
it's just, he's so friendly.
The disparity between the online and like the personalities we know the 2008 alumni by versus the personalities we know the 1993 alumni by are more hilariously contrasted by the day. Like, Philly 93 pitchers are openly racist and hostile or in prison. 2008 pitchers are opening wineries or taking suggestions for restaurants on Twitter.
Joe Blanton! Joe Blanton has turned to winemaking, and I have this article open on my browser, and I haven't been able to check it yet, and I just now realized that I wouldn't have been able to read it because I've reached my article limit for this month. Thanks, Philly.com.
Media.
I don't care, and I'm going to close it and just assume from the headline that Joe Blanton is making wine now.
Yes.
Congratulations to him.
You know who also makes wine? Brian Schneider.
Does he really?
Yes. And that is, 3 seconds of silence is what that information deserves. I agree.
Well, because I'm remembering like last night you alerted us in the Slack that Brian Schneider is now a coach for the Marlins.
Yes.
Like, he didn't disappear off the face of the planet. He's a coach for the Marlins.
I mean, in classic Brian Schneider style, he did actually disappear off the face of the planet, but was also a coach of the Marlins, which was why I was like, did you know about this? Because I didn't know about this. I mean, who's keeping track of Brian Schneider? I'm not.
No, I have to tell you a story. So when the Reds and the Phillies faced each other in Cincinnati, Sean, my boyfriend, and I went to three of the four games. And at the second game, we're walking in, and I see someone with, you know, there were a lot of Phillies fans there, which was really great. I saw someone with a Schneider jersey, like not a shirt, though his son had a shirt, a Schneider shirt that he told me he had to get custom made. He had an actual Brian Schneider jersey. And when I saw him and his son together, his son was probably 20. I had to go up and ask them. I'm like, hi, I'm a fellow Phillies fan. Do you actually have a jersey? Are you wearing a Brian Schneider jersey right now? Can you tell me why? And he said, our last name is Schneider. And when someone with our last name played for the Phillies, we bought everything we could with his name on it.
That's brilliant.
It was not about the player at all. He's like, yeah, the guy was fine. I barely remember him. It was really mostly about that there was a lot of stuff that the Phillies made that had our name on it now.
I have a Brian Schneider fandom story as well.
Tell me.
There was a time when I guess I was watching a game with a friend, and there was we were either in a bar, or this was a point where, you know, adult beverages were rampant, and a bet was made in that if Brian Schneider like came through with a hit and knocked in some runs at a certain point, which I was convinced he would not do because it was Brian Schneider, the weak hitting backup catcher, If he did, my friend bet me that I would have to take a sign with a hand-drawn picture of Brian Schneider on it that said "Schneid's my guy" on it. And he did. He knocked in the runs. And my girlfriend at the time, who was a talented artist, drew a picture of Brian Schneider with the words "Schneid's my guy" underneath. And it never actually made it to a game, but the artwork was still hanging in my apartment for some time. It was framed. There was a framed hand drawn picture of Brian Schneider hanging in one of my apartments in Philadelphia. I'd totally forgotten about that. But how do we get to Brian?
Thank you, Jose Urania, for allowing us to remember these important Brian Schneider stories. Thank you for being shitty.
Yeah.
And hitting Acuna with a pitch on his elbow. He had to leave the game. It doesn't seem like anything's broken, but they have they're doing every test on him they possibly can. If a divining rod would work, if holding a magnet above his elbow would tell them something, they'll do it because they, this probably did what it was intended to do, which is take him out of the game and break his streak. I don't know what the Marlins have to, why they would care considering they have the worst record in the NL East right now and have no hope of making the playoffs and are probably, to be honest, better off continuing to suck and getting a first round draft pick they can, whiff on and screw up and be laughed at for at least another 10 years. So I guess congratulations to them.
It's not about winning or losing, Liz. It's about respect. And I think, as the Marlins would tell you, it's about retupect. And that's something that you need to take seriously in baseball, spelling words with numbers, things that hitting players with the baseball. These are the things that get you retupecked in baseball. And that's honestly what this is all about. So
fuck you, Nike. Thanks a whole lot for that. I mean, I guess, again, we should thank them because that will be a joke forever. Forever.
Well, with the Braves-Marlins rivalry heating up, We'll begin our trip this week back to 2008 with another rivalry, which at this time I suppose they were considered rivals, the Phillies and Dodgers. I mean, they're a rivalry occasionally throughout time. I think that's a generational thing. I know older Phillies fans, maybe one generation older than us, have a particular dislike of the Dodgers. And Trevor and I were just talking about this on the Dirty Inning briefly, that seems to be the case, and that you and I have consider other teams to be the Phillies' rivals based on games we've watched. But in 2008, the Dodgers were, they were a team the Phillies were going to meet in the postseason a couple of times in that stretch of good seasons the Phillies had there. And in 2008, around this time, mid-August, everybody was making adjustments, and we talked last time about when John Stolness was here and Liz was on vacation. We talked about how the Phillies, the Dodgers had gone out and acquired a man named Manny Ramirez as one of their trade deadline difference makers. And the Phillies acquired Scott Ayer and Joe Blanton, future winery owner Joe Blanton. Those were their big moves. So clearly the blockbuster move was Manny Ramirez. And after that move was made, and I won't say all the fanfare died down, because I don't feel like the fanfare ever died down with Manny Ramirez, especially when he went to L.A. The Phillies had the pleasure of playing the Dodgers not too long after that deal was struck. And Manny joined the Dodgers and the Mannywood banner went up. And, it was a whole new era. Dodgers believed they had made the move that would really push their season forward. I always remember it the Phillies, they really had to scrap together 2008. And the Dodgers were pretty good all year, but the Dodgers struggled too. The Dodgers actually didn't have as good a record as the Phillies did before they played each other for a four-game series in LA. And they still didn't after they swept the Phillies in four games in LA. They were still had two wins less than the Phillies. But that series, obviously that series sucked. We can look back on it now. But the month of August had a brutal entry in that mid-month portion where it was Manny Ramirez for four games in L.A., and the Phillies found every single way to lose. They got pounded. They lost on walk-offs. It was brutal. So we're going to take it.
August is usually brutal for the Phillies, though.
Yeah.
I remember, we'll eventually, I'm sure, someday talk about 2011. But that August of 2011 is when the Phillies hit the skids for the first time all season and lost, like, I think, like, an obscene number of games either in a row. Like, they had the longest losing streak, active streak in the majors at that point. And everyone was like, wow, they're failing. And everyone was right.
I mean, in their defense, they did clinch, you know, pretty early.
They did clinch. Like, that's what it was. It was right before they could have clinched, and they kept losing and putting it off. And if only we had prepared ourselves for what was to come.
If only we had prepared ourselves for the Phillies to lose. If only there had been an opportunity in the past over 100 years to prepare ourselves for such a concept. But yeah, they, the Phillies traveled out to LA for a West Coast swing in 2008, right around this time. I believe it was August 11th to the 14th. They were out there at Dodger Stadium, and in game one of that series, they were undone by a 6-run third inning, during a Kyle Kendrick start. And Manny, you know, Manny Ramirez was at the middle of just about every rally or every comeback in this series. The first run of the game, Manny Ramirez, RBI double, knocks in two runs. There was the disastrous third inning for Kyle Kendrick. And Manny started it off. Then in game two, Manny hits an RBI single to cut a 3-1 lead to 3-2. And then there's just a classic 1-2-3. I'm trying to figure out. It was J.C. Romero pitching the bottom of the ninth inning of that game. And with the score tied 3-3, the Dodgers had what we're going to call a 1-2-3 walk-off inning, where J.C. Romero hits Russell Martin with a pitch to lead off the bottom of the ninth in a tie game as the away team, which, great stuff. James Loney grounds out, but that sends Russell Martin to second base, puts him in scoring position. Next batter is Andre Ethier, who singles home Martin, and the game is over. And the Phillies have lost two games in a row. He hits Martin in the foot with the ball. Hits him in the foot to set up that win. Just a real beautiful... I try not to get worked up about past losses. Like, you'll watch, like, sometimes they'll have the, like, 1993 games on, and like the NLCS game where they beat the Braves, and you find yourself yelling at Kevin Stocker for, like, swinging at a terrible pitch. And you're like, what am I doing? I know how this ends. What am I doing?
I know how this ends. I've watched it a number of times. I can't stop myself.
But in game three, the Phillies build a 6-1 lead, which at this point in a 4-game series, you're thinking, like, all right, look, we're obviously not going to get swept. Sweeping is difficult for teams to do when it's just 3 games. Like, 4 games, we're not going to get swept out of Los Angeles. That's not going to happen. So this will be, like, the game that prevents that. They build a 6-1 lead. But then, you know, hey, guess what? Manny Ramirez hits a 2-run shot in the third inning. Dodgers eventually tie the game 6-6. Clay Condrey comes in. And Clay Condrey is actually at the center of a dirty inning that will be coming very soon. That happened the season before. Clay Condrey comes in to pitch the bottom of the ninth. And second hitter is Nomar Garciaparra. It's a home run to end the game. Line drive down the left field line. And that's about all she wrote for the Phillies that night. Now, at this point, frustration is rampant in the Phillies dugout. And I'm gonna show you a picture of Shane Victorino leaning on the railing of the Phillies dugout. And I want you to just see the he's got this, like, childlike look of anger. Like, he's on the verge of tears.
Oh my gosh.
But he looks like,
look at all the hair he has. He has so much hair in this picture.
This was back when Shane Victorino was doing hair, and, like, it was dark hair. And you're just like, wow, that's right. That was 10 years ago. Shane Victorino was just encapsulated, I think, all of the Phillies' feelings at that point. I mean, this was frustrating. That's a really, I don't have to tell you, it's a frustrating way to lose. It's a third straight loss against the Dodgers, which is a team that, you know, they got. Dodgers were 3 games over 500 after that win. The Phillies were 64-57 after that loss. So these were two teams that were both pretty desperate, I think, to see some disparity between their wins and loss columns. And this was a great opportunity for the Phillies to, like, beat a good team and really come through. And the Phillies had proven they could beat good teams. But here they were in Dodger Stadium, just getting slowly erased. And Shane Victorino's face as he leaned on the railing following that loss was just perfect. Like, it was perfect. It was peak Shane Victorino. It characterized the team's feelings at that point as well. Like, it was just, it sucked. What a terrible time. And, you know, they're packing like 51,000 people into Dodger Stadium, and they're all, like, screaming their heads off at this point. And so, you know, you just see it in Shane's face that he's like, we're going to pack it up. We're going to go back to the hotel. We're going to come back here. And tomorrow we're going to just kick ass. We're going to come back from this. That's how this team works. You know, there's no way we're going to get like swept out of LA in four games. Like, no, I refuse. I refuse to let this happen. And the next day they let it fucking happen because they got swept out of LA and they had a dumb little 3-1 loss the next day in which they could not put the bat on the ball. Two hits. Jason Wirth and Chase Utley both hit doubles. Nothing really else happened offensively for the Phillies. I mean, Chris Coast worked a walk. That was the full brunt of the Phillies offense against Hiroki Kuroda, who pitched 7 innings against them and allowed one earned run.
Hiroki Kuroda, good lord.
That was just utter nonsense. I mean, I think Manny didn't factor into this one too much. He just kind of was there. The Phillies were trying to figure out how to like work around him. But the win the previous night the Dodgers had pulled off tied them with the Diamondbacks for first place in the NL West. So this was a huge series for them. And after the Phillies scored those 6 runs to build a 6-1 lead, they went 1-for-21 at the plate. Like they were fully incapable. And that carried over into game 4. Manny did his best. He hit a deep fly ball and the Phillies intentionally walked him at one point, learning their lessons, but no dice. Dodgers still pulled it out. 3-1 victory. The Phillies are now a game back from the Mets in the NL East. They still have a better record than the Dodgers. At this point, I don't know if you remember this. I mean, I remember the Cubs being a part of the playoff picture that year, but they have the best record in baseball at this point. They had 75 wins in mid-August. Like they were,
and then
they were
happened?
On top of things. Exactly. Like you never remember who loses the NLDS, especially the one that like the Phillies didn't play in. So. That just slips out of your mind. That didn't work out for them. But for the Dodgers, you know, this is why they got Manny to be this kind of team, the kind of team that can sweep another competitive team in 4 games at home. You take Manny Ramirez's accomplishments out of that 4-game series, and the Dodgers dropped 3 of those 4 games. Like, he was everything that they acquired him to be, and it was sort of like a dream acquisition. But what cracks me up, I mean, obviously, it's Manny Ramirez. So, but what cracks me up is that the events leading up to the Dodgers acquiring Manny Ramirez, as I'm sure a lot of people can remember, that Manny and the Red Sox, which is where he obviously came from, were no longer in love with each other. We'll go with as far as him being on the team goes. So there was a lot of rumors. There was a lot of teams interested going up to the trade deadline in 2008. That Manny Ramirez was going to go elsewhere. The Red Sox didn't want him on the team anymore. He definitely didn't want to be on the team anymore. And there's events going back to, I mean, there are events going back a long time, but going back to June 5th of this season, I'm going to read you some of the chronicles of Manny leading up to his inevitable trade. So first of all, let's start with this. Manny Ramirez could have been a Met. Wouldn't that have sucked? Like I've come around on players like Manny, and even A-Rod just sort of cracks me up as far as like how goofy they are, and you know the whole Manny being Manny thing was utterly reprehensible. But that wasn't his fault. That was the media's coverage of him and his antics. Some of his shit was just weird. Like that time he brought out an interpreter, even though he speaks English, at a press conference. Like that stuff like that was just like, okay, man, whatever. Seeing him on the Mets with the rest of that lineup, with a 22-year-old David Wright, with Jose Reyes when he was an actual baseball player.
World didn't know him to be an asshole.
Yeah. When they had Pedro Martinez, when they had Carlos Beltran, like Cliff Floyd. I mean, good God, adding Manny Ramirez to that lineup would have made them a real problem, a real threat in the NL East. And probably if this 4-game series with the Dodgers is any indication, might change history. But honestly, the closest the Mets ever got to acquiring Manny Ramirez, they sniffed around him in 2008, but there was nothing serious there. It was in 2005 that Ramirez could have joined the Mets and been a teammate with Mike Piazza, because apparently, according to David Lennon of New York Newsday at this time, he says that the Mets, quote, "The Mets pushed hard to get him from the Red Sox during the December 2004 winter meetings in Anaheim, where Omar Minaya initially laid the groundwork for Pedro Martinez and Carlos Beltran. On July 31st, through 97 games, Ramirez had 28 home runs, 98 RBIs, blah, blah, blah. The Mets had this big threatening lineup. And then, And then they came down to the last 48 hours of the trade deadline, and the Mets made this big push to try and get Manny Ramirez. So just reading Lennon's work here. But aside from being one of the game's most dangerous run producers, Ramirez was still owed $64 million through 2008, a big salary now, but a colossal sum in those days, especially when the Mets already had a $103 million roster. The Mets attempted to get the Rays involved in a three-team swap, but they backed out when they couldn't get shortstop prospect Hanley Ramirez. In the final hours, the Mets thought they had a deal that would send Mike Cameron and Lastings Millage, a double-A outfielder, to the Red Sox, who would pick up a portion of Ramirez's contract. Cameron wasn't thrilled to be playing right field anyway, and the Mets signed Beltran to a seven-year, $119 million contract that offseason. So they tried to get the Rays involved. They tried to get Hanley Ramirez. Like, they did their – I mean, you know, Omar Minaya sucked, but, like, this was
he sucked once and he'll suck again. Let's just he could suck again very soon.
This was a real game changer for the Mets in that it changed nothing at this point because they did not acquire him. But that was one of those potentially pivotal moments in NL East history where we could have been dealing with Manny Ramirez for years. I mean, it was enough playing against him in the NLCS twice. Like, that would have sucked seeing Manny Ramirez 19 times a season. But that didn't happen. Unfortunately, he stayed in the AL. He stayed in the AL East. And the events leading up to his trade to the Dodgers on June 5th, Manny Ramirez and Kevin Youkilis got into, like, an actual fight. The Boston Globe writers could only speculate what it was about and what they came up with.
It could have been about literally.
Which is hilarious. Yeah, because you're just like, oh, well, I think they disagreed on, like, what color the Red Sox uniform should be. Or, like,
Manny was eating some stinky cheese at his locker. Or, you know, it could have been anything.
Yeah, something more likely, like the stinky cheese thing. Absolutely. But what they deduced was Kevin Youkilis didn't like that Manny Ramirez was too slow to enter a brawl that occurred against the Rays. Which is just tremendous. Like, hey, not even that he didn't get into it, that he was too slow to get into it. Like, hey, man, we really could have used you in that, like, pushing and shouting match that we had with another group of 25 grown men. Where were you, bro? Which that's absolutely hysterical. Of course, when Kevin Youkilis speaks, I imagine everything's just muffled through that beard on his face. But they also thought maybe Manny didn't like that Youkilis complained too much about a strike zone, or he also didn't like that Youkilis had, like, thrown his helmet in frustration. I mean, whatever it was, Manny took a swing at him. So the Red Sox had that going on, which seems like it sucked. But later in the season, Manny also pushed a 64-year-old man to the ground, the Red Sox traveling secretary, because Manny had made a game day request for 16 tickets to a game against the Astros in Houston. This guy, Jack McCormick, the Red Sox traveling secretary, like, couldn't get it done. And Manny got frustrated, pushed him to the ground and said, "Just do your job," apparently.
Let's back up. You are a grown-up. You're a grown-up person. You're doing your job. Someone asks you for something. Doesn't even matter. Someone asks you a question you can't answer. And what they do is, in your place of business, at your work, in the hallway, they push you to the ground like you're a five-year-old at the schoolyard. Have you ever been pushed down by an adult, a non-drunk adult person?
I don't think I've been pushed down by a drunk adult person, to be honest.
Like, who does that? Just pushing a person to the ground because they can't do something for you.
it's pretty great. Like, it's, like, not great. Obviously, it's the worst. But at the same time, it's I mean, reading about it now, it's like, who pushes a 64-year-old man just because you don't get what you want? Like, that's Manny being Manny, I guess. In this case, Manny assaulting the elderly. That's the new definition. You know what? I guess the Red Sox just didn't like that for some reason. And on July 25th, Manny Ramirez sits out of a game, tells Terry Francona through the bench coach that he has a knee issue and he can't play. So the Red Sox, at this point, it's just like a game of tic-tac-toe between Manny Ramirez and the Red Sox to see who can be more spiteful. And the Red Sox are like, oh my gosh, you don't feel well? Well, we should send you to the hospital and get an MRI for your knee issue. And he's like, okay. So they send him to the hospital and he gets a pair of MRIs on his knees. And what do you know? There's no damage whatsoever to Manny's knees. Nevertheless, he stops running out his ground balls, and he's not putting any effort in. The fans and columnist Dan Shaughnessy demand that he be traded, which let's take a minute here. I did want to pause and say, what is Dan's job in Boston? What is he? Is he like, I mean, because you got beat writers.
You could ask that question of any number of shitty Phillies, quote unquote, Phillies or Boston columnists.
It's columnists.
This is going to be an unlocked podcast, so I won't say any names. Fill in the blanks yourselves.
But it is columnist, though. That's like his official title. But
I think. But he, I mean, God knows at this point.
Like rabble rouser.
He could just be employed to just yell at the team.
It cracks me up.
Just yell and throw peanuts at
them. It cracks me up when columnists give themselves the role of like the defenders of the fans. When they're just like, they grab like an old timey spear and shield and they're like, I will get behind me. I will protect you from the mean players. Like that stuff that cracks me up because most of the time there's like condescension and patronizing going on between that. That's the typical dynamic, but like, that's why it makes me stop. Like, what's Dan's job? Cause he's one of the more,
he calls himself a columnist. That's what he calls himself. Yes, and I'm trying to, what is the last thing you published here at the Boston Globe? No, I don't want your ads. August 4th, so he's still currently writing.
That's good for him, man.
He should shave.
It's good work when you can get it. But yeah, it's just that's like, is he the chancellor of the fans? Like, I feel like he could go a little more with whatever his job title is. And columnist is, you know, obviously what it formally is, but clearly he does so much more. So at this point he was advocating that Manny be traded. And to be honest, I mean, that's a tough point to argue with at this point when he's pushing old men to the ground and getting in, you know, swinging fights with his teammates and also just kind of not playing baseball. Like that's tradable offense, I would say. So what winds up happening is there's a three-way deal between the Red Sox, Dodgers, and hey, don't forget the Pirates. The Pirates are the third team in the deal, which, hey, no one ever talks about what the Pirates got out of that deal. They got four players. One was Andy LaRoche. One was Brandon Moss. And then there were also two other guys. But I felt like mentioning, they deserved mention at least because this is, you know, it's a forgotten corner of baseball history, the Pirates, what the Pirates gained from the Manny Ramirez trade. So clearly, 2008, big year for the Dodgers, big plans, Manny Wood, everybody wearing the fake dreadlocks, Dan Shaughnessy, everybody's just screaming at the top of their lungs. And now the Phillies got to deal with the Dodgers for four games and they get swept out of LA, largely thanks to Manny Ramirez. That all sucked. 10 days later, the Phillies have to play the Los Angeles Dodgers again for four games, this time in Philadelphia. And boy, oh boy. That's this was one of those series that I'm sure this is some people's moments of like, okay, this team is going to actually, this is a different team than the teams that have failed us before. Cause you go back and you think about Shane Victorino's face while he's leaning on that railing and the Dodgers are dancing around and then take whatever energy he was fermenting in that moment. And it all came out in this series, which it's almost like it was like a Black Mirror episode in that this was like an alternate dimension where that four game series isn't just played like 10 games later. It's played in a different universe where instead of LA, it's in Citizens Bank Park. Instead of the Dodgers beating the Phillies a whole bunch of different ways, the Phillies beat the Dodgers a whole bunch of different ways and nullified the four game sweep that had like been such a momentous moment in the Dodgers season. And now the Phillies got to use a four game series as a momentous occasion. Check this out. In game one, Kyle Kendrick outduels Greg Maddux.
You know, Kendrick had a handful of those outings throughout his career. Like there was one point where like him and Halliday went back to back on nights in Colorado and Halliday got smacked around and Kendrick pitched like Roy Halliday. Like he has every now and then he looked like he knew what he was doing. Whether or not he did is a different story, but every now and then he looked like he knew what he was doing.
Attaboy, Kyle. Yeah, that was a great sentence.
No, shut up, Kyle, forever.
This wasn't primetime Greg Maddux by any stretch of the imagination. But no. It's just a great sense to be able to say, like, yeah, Kyle Kendrick outdueled Greg Maddux in game one of this series. I forgot that Greg Maddux was even a factor in 2008. And
when you said that, I thought, well, he's saying it. It has to be true.
Oh, that's a terrible assumption to make about.
Really, it's for either of us, really.
I just, while you were talking, clicked on Greg Maddux's name in the box score just to be sure it wasn't like a different Greg Maddux, like Maddux with an I that I just looked right past or something. But no, same Greg Maddux, same guy, beaten by
Maddux with an I,
beaten by Kyle Kendrick. Kyle Kendrick only went 5 2/3, but he gave up 1 earned run, 2 walks. And I think at this point, Charlie Manuel was probably adopting kind of what Gabe Kapler was doing in the second game of that Red Sox series, where he was just like, all right, look, the pitching's been solid, but like we need runs and we're going to have to make an adjustment here. And fortunately, it worked out. The Phillies throttled the Dodgers in game one, 8-1. The Dodgers took a 1-0 lead in the first. Andre Ethier hit a home run because Andre Ethier was just that kind of guy in 2008. So already you were just like, oh boy, here we go. But then nothing happened until the fourth. And then the Phillies scored twice in the fourth. They scored in the fifth. They put up 4 runs in the sixth. Like it was finally the offense was coming through. And following that 4-game sweep in LA, Ryan Howard had been interviewed, you know, by a bunch of different reporters, and the Orange County Register has this quote from him where he's just like, we're trying to find ways to get runs across. It's tough right now. It's just weird. I've never been through anything like this. We're a very confident team. The good thing is we'll get another shot at them this week. So, you know, obviously it's just very like, what else are you going to say type of answer, but him just going like, it's just weird. It was just weird. Like when your offense just shuts down, an offense you've been able to trust, an offense, you know, is productive. Yeah, it is just weird. And what the hell else are you going to say? Like, yeah, we knew the 2008 Phillies could hit. These were great hitters in their primes. Like, that was going to happen eventually. It's just when it's not happening, it's hard to imagine it ever happening again. But fortunately, like I said, the Phillies got to play the exact same series but different, you know, just a couple of days later. So they put eight runs up on the Dodgers and pound the life out of them in game one. Scott Ayer nails down a 1-2-3 ninth inning. So the Phillies get to use one of their trade deadline acquisitions, their August acquisitions as well, to show that you got Manny Ramirez. Well, Scott Ayer, he's like the Manny Ramirez of pitching, except like, you know, more reserved and nobody knows who he is. And also he's a pitcher. So in game two, the Phillies did exactly what they've struggled with this season. Doubles, singles, home runs, tons of different types of offense, not just, you know, walking and home runs. And they pound Clayton Kershaw 9-2. Very exciting. This is, I mean, can you imagine, like, it's funny to look back and think like, oh, wow, this team really was able to handle Clayton Kershaw. But then as Clayton Kershaw matured and developed and became the premier pitcher in the game at a point when the Phillies were no longer a premier team in the game, just imagining the Phillies putting 3 runs on Clayton Kershaw in the first inning is just kind of surreal.
Yeah. I mean, now, then, it doesn't matter. He's always been good.
Yeah. Yeah. So, they beat Clayton Kershaw in game two. Game three, Pedro Feliz comes off the bench, ties
Pedro
the game.
Pedro Feliz, my God.
I got to tell you, I didn't recall offhand too many occasions where he was the hero. I know everybody, like, at some point was. But he comes off the bench, ties the game with a 2-out RBI single in the bottom of the ninth, and then wins it with a home run in the bottom of the 11th. It is just an anti, like it just perfectly counters the Dodgers walk-off win in LA. It's just so weird how these series mirrored each other. And also the Phillies rotation lined up that they had the exact same pitchers in the exact same order go in this series that had gone in the last series, which was also strange. Then in game four, just good old fashioned shutout. Nothing really that sexy. RBI single, RBI ground out. Pat Burrell hit into a double play that scored a run. So the Phillies won 5-0. But yeah, they swept the Dodgers out of Philly, nullified that 4-game sweep in LA, and hey, everything was back to normal. Everybody, you know, nobody had any complaints. Everybody felt pretty good about being in Philadelphia and being Philadelphia sports fans, and no one ever had a problem again. Here's a sentence that'll age you, Liz. On The Good Fight, our own former editor Peter Lyons wrote the sentence, "Red hot Brett Myers squares off against young Chad Billingsley." How's that make you feel?
1,000 years old.
Yes, we are.
Young Chad was Chad Billingsley ever young? I guess we have our answer.
Yeah, it's you dip back into that bit of history, and yeah, not only was Brett Myers red hot, but Chad Billingsley was not old, which is yeah, quite the concept. So they sweep the Dodgers. It's a wonderful time to be a Phillies fan again. Then they go to New York. They got to play the Mets. And to cap off such a string of wins, Chris Coase comes off the bench against the Mets, goes 4-for-4, and comes back to help the Phillies erase a 7-run deficit and hits a walk-off in the 13th inning. I mean, that's a pretty off the bench, Chris Coase. My God. So this was.
And if anyone is upset about him having a World Series ring, they should not be. That performance alone earned him a World Series ring.
Are people upset that Chris Coase has a
World Series? I don't think anyone is, but it's like he's one of those players that, you know, had a limited impact, I would say.
In the first,
you know, he's one of those, like, we talked about it earlier this year about, you know, God, what the hell is his name? The dude who played like 2 games for the Phillies early on and then never played again.
That's who I was just about to bring up. Mike Cervenac, I think his name.
Cervenac, yes. I'm like, it's not Pete Incaviglia, which I think is a name you love saying, yeah. But it was a. Pete Cervenac, or Mike Cervenac, whatever his name is, he has a World Series ring, just like Chris Coase.
deservedly so. Chris Coase.
Oh, no, that guy does not have a World Series ring because the Phillies didn't win the World Series that year. let's talk about it some more and rub it in.
Well, in any case, Manny Ramirez goes 2-for-14 in Philadelphia with 3 strikeouts. Goes 0-for-4 in the final game. So unplug Manny and you unplug the Dodgers, which, you know, hey, look. If the Phillies and Dodgers wind up in the playoffs this year facing each other, the parallel of the Dodgers acquiring the best possible player on the market and his name also being Manny is going to be played up so much. That's such a Jason Stark tweet. I look forward to that very much. But yeah, so that's what the 2008 Phillies were up to. Things were going, you know, bad and then good. It was like a full baseball season, essentially. We're going to quick mention the 1993 Phillies. Liz, you weren't here. One of our favorite topics to talk about when we talk about the 1993 Phillies is Lenny Dykstra's brazen steroid usage. and we talked about that in spring training, how he would pretty much did everything but just go ahead and say directly to his GM, Lee Thomas, that, yeah, man, I'm roiding up like crazy, and there's nothing you can say about it. So
I'm doing it right now in front of you. Look at me.
Last time we talked about how this was the time of year where a guy who had helped supply Lenny Dykstra with steroids was like, oh yeah, they were all like water-based. And this was the time of year where the water was coming out. So essentially Lenny Dykstra was deflating steroid-wise, which is just a hysterical image. I mean, I don't think the numbers necessarily reflect that, but just like biologically, that's apparently what was occurring. So that's tremendous. But what we're going to talk about with the 93 Phillies, you know, they started a 6-game road trip. They were in Colorado. They were in Houston. You know, they passed a road attendance mark of 2 million, which apparently, you know, that was like, oh, the Phillies are a big draw this year. So that was like a huge deal. Kevin Stocker was hitting well. He was hitting 324. John Kruk was seeing the ball really well, obviously. Even Mitch Williams was closing games, so things were going pretty normally well. So what we're going to talk about here, Liz, is I'm going to send you a picture for you to look at, and we're just going to talk about this picture. I'm sure you're going to recognize it, but I kind of thought about it because I've seen it before too, and it's in the video yearbook for the 1993 team, and I don't really know what it's for. I'm sure it's for something, and as you're looking at it now, this is a picture of the Phillies' 1993 starting rotation dressed as Cowboys. I'm sure someone out there knows why this picture exists.
What?
Like why this was taken. I'm sure it was for a magazine cover or for some kind of promotional item, whatever. And I've seen it before. It suddenly occurred to me. I don't know why this happened. Like what was the idea behind this? I can tell you my thoughts on it, that Terry Mulholland has the worst hat of the bunch. And Tommy Green looks the best. He looks like a stone cold killer. His hat's cocked in the perfect way. He's the only one with a duster. He looks sweet as hell. So my guess is this was for like Curt Schilling's birthday party, maybe. Like he wanted to have a cowboy themed birthday party. but you know, another better guess would be some kind of promotional item.
Herzlich's birthday party. He's wearing chaps in this, man, over looks like a pair of white jeans, or a pair of light acid wash 90s jeans. Like, this is okay. I have a lot of thoughts.
Look at Danny. First of all, Danny Jackson, very short. Also, Terry Mohan looks very short in this picture too. But look at Danny Jackson's pants and Ben Rivera's pants. Danny Jackson's pants are all scrunched up at the bottom, like he's wearing, like if he pulled on the waistline, he could pull them up to his nipples and they would finally like be appropriately spaced out. Ben Rivera's pants, very tight, super classy.
Incredibly. Well, and I was going to say, out of everybody, Ben Rivera looks like he is wearing almost everything he owns. Like the hat and the vest, he might not have owned. Everyone else got a significant amount of what their current, what they put on from someone else. Like the shirt that Kurt Schilling is wearing has like a has like a U-shaped of buttons on the front with like a bib that's buttoned to it. There's like a, God, one of these guys has got like a weird cummerbund type thing on. And I'm showing how badly I don't, how hard it is for me to recognize these dudes. The guy next to him, the other short dude, with the straight, like this hat looks like it's a, you would see in like one of those early 90s movies that were sort of obsessed with not the West, but like the Mexican West, like the Mexican, God, and there are a bunch of broken bats in front of them for some reason.
This. I think that's supposed to be like they killed those bats. Like, see how, they have baseballs.
Oh, they all have baseballs in their holsters. This is the stupidest. This is the dorkiest picture. This is the nerdiest baseball shit I have ever seen. They're just like, yeah, we're baseball cowboys in our holsters. We've got balls instead of guns, and we'll like they're facing down. It's like they're meeting up with hitters in the street and just taking out the baseball and throwing it. They have one shot to break the bat because they can fit one baseball in their holster.
I wonder if a baseball is difficult to reload. I wonder if that's a problem for them.
That is the problem. You get one baseball, you throw it, it's over. It's like the equivalent of throwing your gun after you run out of bullets, only you have no bullets. It's just
what
the
cracks
gun.
Me up is this picture. I found it in the book Macho Row by William Cassidus, and the caption just says, Phillies starting pitchers dressed as cowboys. Zero context given. Just that they were.
Why?
Again, I'm sure there's a perfectly reasonable explanation for this.
No, there's not. Reasonable explanation for this? No. Because the explanation is, someone wanted everyone to dress up as cowboys and we did it. Or it was a costume party and we all went in matching costumes, or it was Kurt Schilling's birthday, so we did this. The fact that everyone in this photo consented to dressing up in cowboy outfits and taking pictures of each other with the broken bats in front and the baseballs in the holster, there is no reasonable explanation for this anyone for anything.
They probably loved it. I think they probably had a great time doing it.
They probably did. And I'm shitting on their fun because it looks so stupid.
They couldn't figure out a different pose. They went with Kurt Schilling and Ben Rivera are each standing with their arms leaning on one of the two short guys, Mulholland and Danny Jackson. And they're both holding baseballs. It's like they couldn't come up with a different pose for either one of them. Like I will stand by this. Tommy Green looks sweet as hell. Tommy Green looks like if you ran into him in an old-time Western bar, he could actually, like, kill you with a baseball.
The duster, yeah.
The hat.
These guys are getting into it.
He's got a
simmering
glare.
Two of them are wearing leather pants.
Takes you out of it a bit.
One of the pairs of leather pants have, like, one of them are chaps. The other ones have three rows of studs on the side. Maybe that's two. Two rows of studs on the side.
Liz, let me ask you this. How many rows of studs on your leather pants are too many? Would three be too many, or is two too many?
Unless you're going into a leather bar or, I don't know, going on a movie set, any.
Let me ask you this.
What is happening?
So would you see the pants that Terry Mulholland is wearing in this picture, these leather pants with studs, do you think they would go well in the bar that we talked about Terry Mulholland owning on a previous episode of Continuum.
Too much clothing.
He's a part owner, I believe, of a rowdy biker bar, which is, I think, in Arizona.
Oh, I guess you are right. I guess maybe that's true. Maybe it would work. Right now, I'm just really intensely regretting that someone put Kurt Schilling in chaps, and so his crotchal region is like highlighted and emphasized in this photo.
I do.
That is literally the last part of Kurt Schilling that anyone ever needs to think about or see.
I will just say that I think that if the reason for this is just that, like, oh, this was the idea we had for like a magazine cover, a Philadelphia sports team dressed up as cowboys seems like an odd choice.
Oh, I didn't even think about that. How?
Like, maybe the,
how did this get from idea to execution?
If this is like for a magazine cover where the headline like just plays that up, but this isn't like, they're not like out west. They play in the NL East. They play in Philadelphia, and the Cowboys are the most hated rival team of anyone in the city. So yeah, I would just some sort of explanation. Like, I will say Tombstone came out in 1993, but it came out in like Christmas Eve, 1993. So it came out after the baseball season. So they weren't like playing up the popularity of that movie. If anything, they do kind of look like they could be in that movie, dressed at that sort of 90s colliding with old timey. Like, some of them look like they're actually wearing items that I had seen in the movie Tombstone. But again,
like Tombstone or The Unforgiven, or I was going to say Don Juan DeMarco, which is not really the same thing at all, but.
Yeah. So just some questions. And again, I'm sure there's an easy explanation for this, and I might even know the answer and have forgotten it, because it's a prominent picture you see featured in just about anything that the 1993 Phillies are in. But yeah, just curious. And it's certainly worth mentioning, if only because Tommy Green looks like he could have, instead of becoming like a CSN analyst, he could have gone on to a background Western actor and effectively pulled it off. So good for him. But yeah, that's our recap of the 2008 and 1993 Phillies and what they were up to around this time. Again, we're very excited about the developments of continued success in our family of Phillies podcasts and our family of Philly sports podcasts. So we look forward to bringing you more episodes of this show, of the other shows we do, Dirty Inning, of Hittin' Season, and anyone who hadn't subscribed to our Patreon, you're terrible. Now, anyone who hadn't subscribed to our Patreon, you now have access to what all of your friends with $5 have been raving about for weeks. So
Well, for the most part, I think we're still doing a handful of Patreon episodes while we wind things down, just as a thank you to our Patreon people. But yes, we soon everyone will have access to everything that we do and say into a microphone.
Yes, always rely on Liz for what many call more accurate information. So,
quote unquote, correct.
What I'm saying is, when you hear Liz's voice, listen. Otherwise, you know, it's up to you. But thanks for listening to another episode of Continued Success. We'll talk to you next week. And I won't throw to you to get final thoughts, because I know that's an option.
Oh, I do have final thoughts, though. I thought you were going to throw to me for final thoughts. When you're listening to this, by the time you listen to this, you'll know that Aretha Franklin died. She was 76. She was amazing. So do yourself a favor and go and listen to her sing the national anthem before game one of the 1993 World Series. She also sang it before. I just wrote a post on this for Yahoo. She also sang it before game three of the 2011 ALCS. She did a number of beautiful versions before football games, including the Thanksgiving Day game in 2016. She did America the Beautiful in 1987 before WrestleMania 3, which only a small clip of that exists online, which is a shame. But if none of that appeals to you, it's the national anthem, so it may not. Go listen to Say a Little Prayer for You, because she's awesome, and that's all I have to say. Now, those are my final thoughts today.
Couldn't agree more. Thanks for listening, everyone, and we'll talk to you next time on Continued Success.
Hey, everybody, how you doing? Well, that's good. My name is Bill Matz. I am the director of Fun and Games for Broad Street Hockey Radio Podcasts.
And I am Kelly, the deputy managing editor of BroadStreetHockey.com.
I'm Steph Driver, the NHL editorial manager for SB Nation.
And I am Charlie O'Connor, lead Flyers writer for TheAthletic.com.
And together we make up BSH Radio, one of the shows that you get at the SB Nation podcast family. We have a lot coming to you this year, and we want you to listen to our show. It is just an all flyers, all the time show. So much content. I really hope you listen to it. It is a great piece of the SB Nation podcast family, along with all your other favorite sports.
We all love hockey, specifically the Flyers.
Let's go the Flyers.
The hockey team, the Flyers.